This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Two Kinds of Truth. Written by Michael Connelly. Read by Titus Welliver.
For Heather Rizzo, thanks for the title and everything else. Part 1. Cappers. Chapter 1. Bosch was in cell 3 of the old San Fernando jail, looking through files from one of the Esme Tavares boxes, when a heads-up text came in from Bella Lourdes over in the Detective Bureau. LAPD and DA heading your way. Trevino told them where you are. Bosch was where he was at the start of most weeks, sitting at his makeshift desk, a wooden door he had borrowed from the public works yard and placed across two stacks of file boxes. After sending Lourdes a thank-you text, he opened the memo app on his phone and turned on the recorder. He put the phone screen down on the desk and partially covered it with a file from the Tavares box. It was a just-in-case move. He had no idea why people from the district attorney's office and his old police department were coming to see him first thing on a Monday morning. He had not received a call alerting him to the visit, though to be fair, cellular connection within the steel bars of the cell was virtually non-existent. Still, he knew that the surprise visit was often a tactical move. Bosch's relationship with the LAPD since his forced retirement 3 years earlier had been strained at best, and his attorney had urged him to protect himself by documenting all interactions with the department. While he waited for them, he went back to the file at hand. He was looking through statements taken in the weeks after Tavares had disappeared. He had read them before, but he believed that the case files often contained the secret to cracking a cold case. It was all there if you could find it. A logic discrepancy, a hidden clue, a contradictory statement, an investigator's handwritten note in the margin of a report. All of these things had helped Bosch clear cases in a career 4 decades long and counting. There were 3 file boxes on the Tavares case. Officially, it was a missing persons case, but it had gathered 3 feet of stacked files over 15 years, because it was classified as such only because a body had never been found. When Bosch came to the San Fernando Police Department to volunteer his skills looking at cold case files, he had asked Chief Anthony Valdez where to start. The chief, who had been with the department 25 years, told him to start with Esmeralda Tavares. It was the case that had haunted Valdez as an investigator, but as a police chief, he could not give adequate time to it. In 2 years working in San Fernando part-time, Bosch had reopened several cases and closed nearly a dozen, multiple rapes and murders among them. But he came back to Esme Tavares whenever he had an hour here and there to look through the file boxes. She was beginning to haunt him, too. A young mother who vanished, leaving a sleeping baby in a crib. It might be classified as a missing persons case, but Bosch didn't have to read through even the first box to know what the chief and every investigator before him knew. Foul play was most likely involved. Esme Tavares was more than missing. She was dead. Bosch heard the metal door to the jail wing open and then footsteps on the concrete floor that ran in front of the 3 group cells. He looked up through the iron bars and was surprised by who he saw. "Hello, Harry." It was his former partner, Lucia Soto, along with 2 men in suits whom Bosch didn't recognize. The fact that Soto had apparently not let him know they were coming put Bosch on alert. It was a 40-minute drive from both the LAPD's headquarters and the DA's office downtown to San Fernando. That left plenty of time to type out a text and say, "Harry, we are heading your way." But that hadn't happened, so he assumed that the 2 men, whom he didn't know, had put the clamps on Soto.
"Lucia. Long time," Bosch said. "How are you, partner?"
It looked like none of the 3 were interested in entering Bosch's cell, even if it had been repurposed. He stood up, deftly grabbing his phone from beneath the files on the desk and transferring it to his shirt pocket, placing the screen against his chest. He walked to the bars and stuck his hand through. Though he had talked to Soto intermittently by phone and text over the past couple of years, he had not seen her. Her appearance had changed. She had lost weight,
and she looked drawn and tired, her dark eyes worried. Rather than shaking his hand, she squeezed it. Her grip was tight, and he took that as a message. Be careful here. It was easy for Bosch to figure out who was who between the two men. Both were in their early 40s and dressed in suits that most likely came off the rack at Men's Warehouse. But the man on the left's pinstripes were showing wear from the inside out. Bosch knew that meant he was wearing a shoulder rig beneath the jacket, and the hard edge of his weapon's slide was wearing through the fabric. Bosch guessed that the silk lining had already been chewed up. In 6 months, the suit would be toast. Bob Tapscott, he said. Lucky Lucy's partner now. Tapscott was black, and Bosch wondered if he was related to Horace Tapscott, the late South L.A. musician who had been vital in preserving the community's jazz identity. And I'm Alex Kennedy, deputy district attorney, said the second man. We'd like to talk to you if you have a few minutes. Sure, Bosch said. Step into my office. He gestured toward the confines of the former cell, now fitted with steel shelves containing case files. There was a long communal bench left over from the cell's previous existence as a drunk tank. Bosch had files from different cases lined up to review on the bench. He started stacking them to make room for his visitors to sit, even though he was pretty sure they wouldn't. Actually, we talked to your Captain Trevino, and he says we can use the war room over in the Detective Bureau, Tapscott said. It will be more comfortable. Do you mind? I don't mind if the captain doesn't mind, Bosch said. What's this about, anyway? Preston Borders, Soto said. Bosch was walking toward the open door of the cell. The name put a slight pause in his step. Let's wait until we're in the war room, Kennedy said quickly. Then we can talk. Soto gave Bosch a look that seemed to impart the message that she was under the DA's thumb on this case. He grabbed his keys and the padlock off the desk, stepped out of the cell, and then slid the metal door closed with a heavy clang. The key to the cell had disappeared long ago, and Bosch wrapped a bicycle chain around the bars and secured the door with a padlock. They left the old jail and walked through the public works equipment yard out to First Street. While waiting for traffic to pass, Bosch casually pulled his phone out of his pocket and checked for messages. He had received nothing from Soto or anyone else prior to the arrival of the party from downtown. He kept the recording going and put the phone back in his pocket. Soto spoke, but not about the case that had brought her up to San Fernando. Is that really your office, Harry? She asked. I mean, they put you in a jail cell? Yep, Bosch said. That was the drunk tank, and sometimes I think I can still smell the puke when I open it up in the morning. Supposedly 5 or 6 guys hung themselves in there over the years. It's supposed to be haunted, but it's where they keep the cold case files, so it's where I do my work. They store old evidence boxes in the other 2 cells, so easy access all around, and usually nobody to bother me. He hoped the implication of the last line was clear to his visitors. So they have no jail? Soto asked. They have to run bodies down to Van Nuys? Bosch pointed across the street to the police station they were heading toward. Only the women go down to Van Nuys, Bosch said. We have a jail here for the men, in the station. State-of-the-art single cells. I've even stayed over a few times. Beats the bunk room at the PAB with everybody snoring. She threw him a look, as if to say he had changed if he was willing to sleep in a jail cell. He winked at her. I can work anywhere, he said. I can sleep anywhere. When the traffic cleared, they crossed over to the police station and entered through the main lobby. The detective bureau had a direct entrance on the right. Bosch opened it with a key card and held the door as the other stepped in. The bureau was no bigger than a single-car garage. At its center were 3 workstations tightly positioned in a single module. These belonged to the unit's 3 full-time detectives, Danny Sisto, a recently promoted detective named Oscar Luzon, and Bella Lourdes, just 2 months back from a lengthy injured-on-duty leave. The walls of the unit were lined with file cabinets, radio chargers, a coffee setup, and a printing station below bulletin boards covered in work schedules and departmental announcements. There were also numerous wanted and missing posters, including a variety showing photos of Esme Tavares that had been issued over a period of 15 years. Up high on one wall was a poster depicting the iconic Disney ducks Huey, Dewey, and Louie, which were the proud nicknames of the 3 detectives who worked in the module below. Captain Trevino's office was to the right, and the war room was on the left. A third room was subleased to the medical examiner's office, and used by two coroner's investigators, who covered the entire San Fernando Valley and points north. All three of the detectives were at their respective workstations. They had recently cracked a major car theft ring operating out of the city, and an attorney for one of the suspects had derisively referred to them as Huey, Dewey, and Louie. They took the group nickname as a badge of honor. Bosch saw Lourdes peeking over a partition from her desk. He gave her a nod of thanks for the heads up. It was also a sign that so far things were okay. Bosch led the visitors into the war room. It was a soundproof room with walls lined with whiteboards and flat-screen monitors. At the center was a boardroom-style table, with eight leather chairs around it. The room was designed to be the command post for major crime investigations, task force operations, and coordinating responses to public emergencies such as earthquakes and riots. The reality was that such incidents were rare, and the room was used primarily as a lunchroom, the broad table and comfortable chairs perfect for group lunches. The room carried the distinct odor of Mexican food. The owner of Magali's Tamales up on McClay Avenue routinely dropped off free food for the troops, and it was usually devoured in the war room. "Have a seat," Bosch said. Tapscott and Soto sat on one side of the table while Kennedy went around and sat across from them. Bosch took a chair at one end of the table, so you would have angles on all three visitors. "So, what's going on?" he said. "Well, let's properly introduce ourselves," Kennedy began. "You, of course, know Detective Soto from your work together in the Open Unsolved Unit, and now you've met Detective Tapscott. They've been working with me on a review of a homicide case you handled almost 30 years ago."
"Preston Borders," Bosch said.
"How is Preston? Still on death row at the queue last time I checked."
"He's still there."
"So why are you looking at the case?" Kennedy had pulled his chair close and had his arms folded and his elbows on the table. He drum-rolled the fingers of his left hand, as if deciding how to answer Bosch's question, even though it was clear that everything about this surprise visit was rehearsed.
"I'm assigned to the Conviction Integrity Unit," Kennedy said. "I'm sure you've heard of it. I have used Detectives Tapscott and Soto on some of the cases I've handled because of their skill in working cold cases." Bosch knew that the CIU was new and had been put into place after he left the LAPD. Its formation was the fulfillment of a promise made during a heated election campaign in which the policing of the police was a hot-ticket debate issue. The newly elected DA, Tak Kobayashi, had promised to create a unit that would respond to the seeming groundswell of cases where new forensic technologies had led to hundreds of exonerations of people imprisoned across the country. Not only was new science leading the way, but old science, once thought to be unassailable as evidence, was being debunked and swinging open prison doors for the innocent. As soon as Kennedy mentioned his assignment, Bosch put everything together and knew what was going on. Borders, the man thought to have killed three women but convicted of only one murder, was making a final grab at freedom after nearly 30 years on death row.
"You gotta be kidding me, right?" Bosch said.
"Borders?
Really? You are seriously looking at that case?" He looked from Kennedy to his old partner, Soto. He felt totally betrayed.
"Lucia," he said.
"Harry," she said, "you need to listen."
Chapter 2 Bosch felt like the walls of the war room were closing in on him. In his mind and in reality, he had put Borders away for good. He didn't count on the sadistic sex murderer ever getting the needle. But death row was still its own particular hell, one that was harsher than any sentence that put a man in general population. The isolation of it was what Borders deserved. He went up to San Quentin as a 26-year-old man. To Bosch, that meant 50-plus years of solitary confinement, less only if he got lucky. More inmates died of suicide than the needle on death row in California.
"It's not as simple as you think," Kennedy said.
"Really?" Bosch said. "Tell me why."
"The obligation of the Conviction Integrity Unit is to consider all legitimate petitions that come to it. Our review process is the first stage, and that happens in-house before the cases go to the LAPD or other law enforcement. When a case meets a certain threshold of concern, we go to the next step and call in law enforcement to carry out a due diligence investigation."
"Then, of course, everyone is sworn to secrecy at that point." Bosch looked at Soto as he said it. She looked away.
Absolutely, Kennedy said.
I don't know what evidence Borders or his lawyer brought to you, but it's bullshit, Bosch said. He murdered Danielle Schuyler and everything else is a scam. Kennedy didn't respond, but from his look, Bosch could tell he was surprised he still remembered the victim's name.
Yeah, 30 years later I remember her name, Bosch said. I also remember Donna Timmons and Vicky Novotny, the two victims your office claimed we didn't have enough evidence to file on. Were they part of this due diligence you conducted?
Harry, Soto said, trying to calm him.
Borders didn't bring any new evidence, Kennedy said. It was already there.
That hit Bosch like a punch. He knew Kennedy was talking about the physical evidence from the case. The implication was that there was evidence from the crime scene or elsewhere that cleared Borders of the crime. The greater implication was incompetence or, worse, malfeasance, that Bosch had missed the evidence or intentionally withheld it.
What are we talking about here? He asked.
DNA, Kennedy said. It wasn't part of the original case in 88. The case was prosecuted before DNA was allowed into use in criminal cases in California. It wasn't introduced and accepted by a court up in Ventura for another year. In L.A. County, it was a year after that.
We didn't need DNA, Bosch said. We found the victim's property hidden in Borders' apartment.
Kennedy nodded to Soto.
We went to property and pulled the box, she said.
You know the routine. We took clothing collected from the victim to the lab, and they put it through the serology protocol.
They did a protocol 30 years ago, Bosch said, but back then they looked for ABO genetic markers instead of DNA, and they found nothing.
You're going to tell me that...
They found semen, Kennedy said. It was a minute amount, but this time they found it. The process has obviously gotten more sophisticated since this killing, and what they found didn't come from Borders.
Bosch shook his head.
Okay, I'll bite, he said. Whose was it?
A rapist named Lucas John Ulmer, Soto said.
Bosch had never heard of Ulmer. His mind went to work, looking for the scam, the fix, but not considering that he had been wrong when he closed the cuffs around Borders' wrists.
Ulmer's in San Quentin, right? He said.
This whole thing is a...
No, he's not, Tapscott said. He's dead.
Give us a little credit, Harry, Soto said. It's not like we went looking for it to be this way.
Ulmer was never in San Quentin. He died in Corcoran back in 2015, and he never knew Borders.
We checked in 6 ways from Sunday, Tapscott said. The prisons are 300 miles apart, and they did not know or communicate with each other. It's not there.
There was a certain gotcha smugness in the way Tapscott spoke. It gave Bosch the urge to backhand him across the mouth.
Soto knew her old partner's triggers and reached over to put a hand on Bosch's arm.
Harry, this is not your fault, she said. This is on the lab. The reports are all there, you're right. They found nothing. They missed it back then.
Bosch looked at her and pulled his arm back.
You really believe that, he said?
Because I don't. This is Borders. He's behind this somehow. I know it.
How, Harry? We've looked for the fix in this.
Who's been in the box since the trial?
No one. In fact, the last one in that box was you. The original seals were intact with your signature and the date right across the top.
Show him the video.
She nodded to Tapscott, who pulled his phone and opened up a video. He turned the screen to Bosch.
This is at Piper Tech, he said.
Piper Tech was a massive complex in downtown where the LAPD's property control unit was located, along with the fingerprint unit and the Aero Squadron, using the football field-sized roof as a heliport. Bosch knew that the integrity protocol in the archival unit was high. Sworn officers had to provide departmental ID and fingerprints to pull evidence from any case. The boxes were opened in an examination area under 24-hour video surveillance. But this was Tapscott's own video, recorded on his phone.
This was not our first go-round with CIU, so we have our own protocol, Tapscott said. One of us opens the box, the other person records the whole thing. Doesn't matter that they have their own cameras down there. And as you can see, no seal is broken, no tampering.
The video showed Soto displaying the box to the camera, turning it over so that all sides and seams could be seen as intact. The seams had been sealed with the old labels used back in the 80s. For at least the past couple of decades, the department had been using red evidence tape that cracked and peeled if tampered with.
Back in 1988, white rectangular stickers with LAPD analyzed evidence printed on them along with the signature and dateline were used to seal evidence boxes. Soto manipulated the box in a bored manner, and Bosch read that as her thinking they were wasting their time on this one. At least up until that point, Bosch still had her in his court. Tapscott came in close on the seals used on the top seam of the box. Bosch could see his signature on the top center sticker along with the date September 9, 1988. He knew the date would have placed the sealing of the box at the end of the trial. Bosch had returned the evidence, sealed the box, and then stored it in property control in case an appeal overturned the verdict and they had to go to trial again. That never happened with Borders, and the box had presumably stayed on a shelf in property control, avoiding any intermittent clearouts of old evidence, because he had also clearly marked on the box 187, the California Penal Code for murder, which in the evidence room meant don't throw away. As Tapscott moved the camera, Bosch recognized his own routine of using evidence seals on all seams of the box, including the bottom. He had always done it that way, till they moved on to the red evidence tape. "Go back," Bosch said. "Let me just look at the signature again." Tapscott pulled the phone back, manipulated the video, and then froze the image on the close-up of the seal Bosch had signed. He held the screen out to Bosch, who leaned in to study it. The signature was faded and hard to read, but it looked legit. "Okay," Bosch said. Tapscott restarted the video. On the screen, Soto used a box cutter attached by a wire to an examination table to slice through the labels and open the box. As she started removing items from the box, including the victim's clothing and an envelope containing her fingernail clippings, she called each piece of property out so it would be duly recorded. Among the items she mentioned was a seahorse pendant, which had been the key piece of evidence against Borders. Before the video was over, Tapscott impatiently pulled the phone back and killed the playback. He then put the phone away. "On and on like that," he said. "Nobody fucked with the box, Harry. What was in it had been there since the day you sealed it after the trial." Bosch was annoyed that he didn't get a chance to watch the video in its entirety. Something about Tapscott, a stranger using his first name, also bothered Bosch. He put that annoyance aside and was silent for a long moment as he considered for the first time that his 30-year belief that he had put a sadistic killer away for good was bogus. "Where'd they find it?" he finally asked. "Find what?" Kennedy asked. "The DNA," Bosch said. "One microdot on the victim's pajama bottoms," Kennedy said. "Easy to have missed back in 87, Soto said. "They were probably just using blacklights then." Bosch nodded. "So what happens now?" he asked. Soto looked at Kennedy. The question was his to answer. "There's a hearing on a habeas motion scheduled in Department 107 a week from Wednesday," the prosecutor said. "We'll be joining Borders' attorneys and asking Judge Houghton to vacate the sentence and release him from death row." "Jesus Christ," Bosch said. "His lawyer has also notified the city that he'll be filing a claim," Kennedy continued. "We've been in contact with the city attorney's office, and they hope to negotiate a settlement. We're probably talking well into seven figures." Bosch looked down at the table. He couldn't hold anyone's eyes. "And I have to warn you," Kennedy said, "if a settlement is not reached and he files a claim in federal court, he can go after you personally." Bosch nodded. He knew that already. A civil rights claim filed by Borders would leave Bosch personally responsible for damages if the city chose not to cover him. Since 2 years ago, Bosch had sued the city to reinstate his full pension, it was unlikely that he would find a single soul in the city attorney's office interested in indemnifying him against damages collected by Borders. The one thought that pushed through this reality was of his daughter. He could be left with nothing but an insurance policy going to her after he was gone. "I'm sorry," Soto said. "If there were any other..." She didn't finish, and he slowly brought his eyes up to hers. 9 days, he said. "What do you mean?" she said. "The hearings are 9 days. I have until then to figure out how he did it." "Harry, we've been working this for 5 weeks. There's nothing. This was before Ulmer was on anybody's radar. All we know is he wasn't in jail at the time and he was in L.A. We found work records. But the DNA is the DNA. On her nightclothes, DNA from a man later convicted of multiple abduction rapes. All cases, home intrusions,
very similar to Skyler's, but without the death. I mean, look at the facts. No DA in the world would touch this or go any other way with it. Kennedy cleared his throat.
We came here today out of respect for you, Detective, and all the cases you've cleared over time. We don't want to get into an adversarial position on this. That would not be good for you.
And you don't think every one of those cases I cleared is affected by this, Bosch said? You opened the door to this guy, and you might as well open it for every one of the people I sent away. If you put it on the lab, same thing. It taints everything.
Bosch leaned back and stared at his old partner. He had at one time been her mentor. She had to know what this was doing to him.
It is what it is, Kennedy said. We have an obligation. Better that 100 guilty men go free than one innocent man be imprisoned.
Spare me your bastardized Ben Franklin bullshit, Bosch said. We found evidence connecting Borders to all three of those women's disappearances, and your office passed on two of them, some snot-nosed prosecutor saying that there was not enough. This doesn't fucking make sense. I want the 9 days to do my own investigation, and I want access to everything you have and everything you've done.
He looked at Soto as he said it, but Kennedy responded.
Not going to happen, Detective, he said.
As I said, we're here as a courtesy, but you're not on this case anymore.
Before Bosch could counter, there was a sharp knock on the door, and it was cracked open. Bella Lourdes stood there. She waved him out.
Harry, she said, we need to talk right now.
There was an urgency in her voice that Bosch could not ignore. He looked back at the others seated at the table and started to get up.
Hold on a second, he said. We're not done.
He stood up and went to the door. Lourdes signaled him all the way out with her fingers. She closed the door behind him. He noticed that the squad room was now empty. No one in the module. The captain's door open and his desk chair empty. And Lourdes was clearly agitated. She used both hands to hook her short dark hair behind her ears, an anxiety habit Bosch had noticed the petite compact detective had been exhibiting since coming back to work.
What's up?
We've got two down in a robbery at a farmacia on the mall.
Two what, officers?
No, people there, behind the counter. Two 187s. The chief wants all hands on this. Are you ready? You want to ride with me?
Bosch looked back at the closed door of the war room and thought about what had been said in there. What was he going to do about it? How was he going to handle it?
Harry, come on, I gotta go. You in or out?
Bosch looked at her. Okay, let's go. They moved quickly toward the exit that took them directly into the side lot, where detectives and command staff parked. He pulled his phone out of his shirt pocket and turned off the recording app.
What about them, Lourdes said.
Fuck them, Bosch said. They'll figure it out.
Chapter 3 San Fernando was a municipality barely 2.5 square miles and surrounded on all sides by the city of Los Angeles. To Harry Bosch, it was the proverbial needle in the haystack, the tiny place and job he had found when his time with the LAPD ended with him still believing he had more to give and a mission unfulfilled, but seemingly no place to go. Racked by budgetary shortfalls in the years that followed the 2008 recession, and having laid off a quarter of its 40 officers, the police department actively pursued the creation of a voluntary corps of retired law officers to work in every section of the department, from patrol to communications to detectives. When Chief Valdez reached out to Bosch and said he had an old jail cell full of cold cases and no one to work them, it was like a lifeline had been thrown to a drowning man. Bosch was alone and certainly adrift, having unceremoniously left the department he had served for almost 40 years, at the same time that his daughter left home for college. Most of all, the offer came at a time when he felt unfinished. After all the years he had put in, he never expected to walk out the door one day at the LAPD and not be allowed back in. At a period in his life when most men took up golf or bought a boat, Bosch felt resolutely incomplete. He was a closer. He needed to work cases, and setting up shop as a private eye or a defense investigator wasn't going to suit him in the long run. He took the offer from the chief, and soon was proving he was a closer at the SFPD, and he quickly went from part-time hours, working cold cases, to mentoring the entire detective bureau. Huey, Dewey, and Louie were dedicated and good investigators, but together they had a total of less than 10 years' experience as detectives. Captain Trevino was only part-time in the unit himself, as he was also responsible for supervising both the communications unit
and the jail. It fell to Bosch to teach Lourdes, Sisto, and Luzon the mission. The mall was a two-block stretch of San Fernando Road that went through the middle of town and was lined with small shops, businesses, bars, and restaurants. It was in a historic part of the city and was anchored on one end by a large department store that had been closed and vacant for several years, the JCPenney sign still on the front facade. Most of the other signs were in Spanish, and the businesses catered to the city's Latino majority, mostly bridal and quinceanera salons, second-hand shops, and stores that sold products from Mexico. It was a 3-minute drive from the police station to the scene of the shooting. Lourdes drove her unmarked city car. Bosch tried his best to put the Borders case in what had been discussed in the war room behind him, so that he could concentrate on the task at hand. "So what do we know?" he asked. "Two dead at La Farmacia Familia," Lourdes said. "Called in by a customer who went in and saw one of the victims. Patrol found the second in the back. Both employees. Looks like a father and son." "The son an adult?" "Yes." "Gang affiliation?" "No word." "What else?" "That's it. Gooden and Sanders headed out when we got the call. Sheriff's forensics have been called." Gooden and Sanders were the two coroner's investigators, who worked out of the subleased office in the detective bureau. It was a lucky break having them so close. Bosch remembered sometimes waiting for an hour or longer for coroner's investigators when he worked cases for the LAPD. While Bosch had solved 3 cold case murders since coming to work for San Fernando, this would be the first live murder investigation, so to speak, since his arrival. It meant there would be an active crime scene, with victims on the floor, not just photos from a file to observe. The protocol and pace would be quite different, and it invigorated him, despite the upset from the meeting he had just escaped from. As Lourdes turned into the mall, Bosch looked ahead and saw that the investigation was already starting off wrong. 3 patrol cars were parked directly in front of the Farmacia, and that was too close. Traffic through the 2-lane mall had not been stopped, and drivers were going slowly by the business, hoping to catch a glimpse of whatever had caused the police activity. "Pull in here," he said. "Those cars are too close, and I'm going to move them back and shut down the street." Lourdes did as he instructed and parked the car in front of a bar called the Tres Reyes and well behind a growing crowd of onlookers gathering near the drugstore. Bosch and Lourdes were soon out of the car and weaving through the crowd. Yellow crime scene tape had been strung between the 2 patrol cars, and 2 officers stood conferring by the trunk of one car while another stood with his hands on his belt buckle, a common patrol officer pose, watching the front door of the Farmacia. Bosch saw that the front door of the store containing the crime scene was propped open with a sandbag, which had probably come from the trunk of a patrol car. There was no sign of Chief Valdez or any of the other investigators, and Bosch knew that meant they were all inside. "Shit," he said as he approached the door.
"What?"
Lourdes asked. "Too many cooks," Bosch said. "Wait out here for a minute." Bosch entered the pharmacy, leaving Lourdes outside. It was a small business with just a few retail aisles leading back to a rear counter where the actual pharmacy was located. He saw Valdez standing with Sisto and Luzon behind the counter. They were looking down at what Bosch guessed was one of the bodies. There was no sign of Trevino. Bosch gave a short, low whistle that drew their attention and then signaled them to come to the front of the store. He then turned around and walked back out the door. Outside, he waited by the door with Lourdes, and when the 3 men stepped out, he pushed the sandbag out of the way with his foot and let the door close. "Chief, can I start us off?" he asked. Bosch looked at Valdez and waited for the chief to give him the nod. He was asking to take charge of the investigation, and he wanted it clear to all parties. "Take it, Harry," Valdez said. Bosch got the attention of the patrol officers huddled together and then signaled them over as well. "Okay, listen up, everybody," Bosch said. "Our number one priority here is to protect the crime scene, and we're not doing that. Patrol, I want you guys to move your cars out and shut down this block on both ends. Tape it up. Nobody comes in without authorization. I then want clipboards on both ends, and you write down the name of every cop or lab rat that comes into the crime scene. You write down the license plate number of every car you let out, too." Nobody moved.
"You heard him," Valdez said. "Let's move it, people. We've got 2 citizens on the floor in there. We need to do this right by them and the department."
The patrol officers quickly returned to their cars to carry out Bosch's orders. Bosch and the other detectives then split up and started moving the gathered onlookers back up the street. Some shouted questions in Spanish, but Bosch did not reply. He scanned the faces of those he was pushing back. He knew the killer could be among them. It wouldn't be the first time. After a two-zone crime scene had been established, Bosch and the chief and the three detectives reconvened by the door of the pharmacy. Bosch once more looked at Valdez for confirmation of his authority, because he didn't expect his next move to go over well. "I still have this, chief?" he asked.
"All yours, Harry," Valdez said. "How do you want to do it?"
"Okay, we want to limit people inside the crime scene," Bosch said. "We get this thing into court and a defense lawyer sees all of us crammed in there, wandering around, and it just gives him more targets to potshot, more confusion to throw at a jury. So there's only going to be two people inside, and that's going to be Lourdes and me. Sisto and Luzon, you've got the exterior crime scene. I want you going down the street in both directions. We're looking for witnesses and cameras. We
got here first," Luzon said, pointing to himself and Sisto. "It should be our case and us inside."
At about 40, Luzon was the oldest of the three full-time investigators, but he had the least experience as a detective. He was moved into the unit 6 months earlier after spending 12 years in patrol. He had gotten a promotion to fill the void left by Lourdes's leave of absence, and then Valdez found the money and the budget to keep him on board at a time when there was a spike in property crimes attributed to a local gang called the Sanfurs. Bosch had observed him since he'd gotten the promotion and concluded he was a good and earnest detective, a good choice by Valdez. But Bosch had not yet worked with him on a case, and he had had that experience with Lourdes. He wanted her to take the lead on this.
"That's not how it works," Bosch said. "Lourdes is going to be lead. I need you and Sisto to go two blocks in both directions. We're looking for the getaway vehicle. We're also looking for video, and I need you guys to find it. It's important."
Bosch could see Luzon fighting back the urge to again argue Bosch's orders. But he looked at the chief, who stood with his arms folded in front of his chest, and saw no indication that the man ultimately in charge disagreed with Bosch.
"You got it," he said.
He went in one direction, while Sisto headed off in the other. Sisto did not bother to complain about the assignment, but had a hangdog look on his face.
"Hey, guys," Bosch said.
Luzon and Sisto looked back. Bosch gestured to Lourdes and the chief to include them.
"Look, I'm not trying to be an arrogant ass," he said. "My experience comes with a lot of fuck-ups. We learn from our mistakes. And in over 30 years of working homicides, I've made many. I'm just trying to use what I've learned the hard way, okay?"
Reluctant nods came from Luzon and Sisto as they headed off to their assignments. "Take down plates and phone numbers," Bosch called after them, immediately realizing it was an unneeded directive. Once they were gone, the chief stepped away from the huddle.
"Harry," Valdez said, "let's talk for a second."
Bosch followed him, awkwardly leaving Lourdes alone on the sidewalk. The chief spoke quietly.
"Look, I get what you're doing with those two and what you said about learning the hard way, but I want you on lead. Bella's good, but she's just back and getting her feet wet. This homicide is what you've been doing for 30 years. This is why you're here."
"I get that, chief, but you don't want me on lead. We have to think about when this gets into court. Everything's about building a case for trial, and you don't want a part-timer on lead. You want Bella. They try character assassination on her, and she'll eat their lunch after what happened last year, what she went through, and then her coming back to the job. She's a hero, and that's who you want on the witness stand. On top of that, she's good, and she's ready for this. And besides, I may have some problems coming up soon from downtown. Problems that could be a big distraction. You don't want me on lead."
Valdez looked at him. He knew that downtown meant from outside the SFPD, from Bosch's past.
"I heard you had visitors this morning," he said. "We'll talk about that later. Where do you want me?"
"Media relations," Bosch said. "They'll get wind of this soon enough, and we'll start showing up. Two dead on Main Street will be a story. You need to set up a command post and corral them when they start coming in. We want to control what information gets out there."
"Understood. What else?"
"You need more bodies for the canvas. I can pull people in from patrol, take one officer out of every car, and run solo patrols till we get a handle on this."
"That would be good. There were people in all of these shops. Somebody saw something."
"You got it. What if I can get the old Pennies open and we can use that as the CP?
I know the guy who owns the building.
Bosch looked across the street and down half a block at the facade of the long-closed department store.
We're going to be out here late. If you can get lights on in there, go for it.
What about Captain Trevino? Is he around?
I have him covering the shop while I am here.
You need him?
No, I can fill him in on things later.
Then I'll leave you to it. We really need a quick conclusion to this, Harry, if there is one.
Roger that.
The chief headed off, and Lourdes came up to Bosch.
Let me guess. He didn't want me as lead, she said.
He wanted me, Bosch said. But it was no reflection on you.
I said no. I said it was your case.
Does that have something to do with the three visitors you had this morning?
Maybe. And it has to do with you being able to handle it. Why don't you go in and watch over Gooden and Sanders? I'll call the sheriff's lab and get an ETA. First thing we want are photos. Don't let those guys move the bodies around until we get the full photo spread.
Roger that.
The bodies belong to the coroner, but the crime scene is ours. Remember that.
Lourdes headed toward the door of the Farmacia, and Bosch pulled his phone. The SFPD was so small it did not have its own forensics team. It relied on the sheriff's department crime scene unit, and that often put it in second position for services. Bosch called the liaison at the lab and was told a team was on the road to San Fernando as they spoke. Bosch reminded the liaison that they were working a double murder and asked for a second team, but he was denied and told there wasn't a second team to spare. They were getting two techs and a photographer-videographer, and that was it. As he hung up, Bosch noticed one of the patrol officers he had given orders to earlier was standing at the new crime scene perimeter at the end of the block. Yellow tape had been strung completely across, closing the road through the mall.
The patrol officer had his hands on his belt buckle and was watching Bosch.
Bosch put his phone away and walked up the street to the yellow tape and the officer manning it.
Don't look in, Bosch said. Look out.
What? The officer asked.
You're watching the detectives. You should be watching the street.
Bosch put his hand on the officer's shoulder and turned him toward the tape.
Look outward from a crime scene. Look for people watching, people who don't fit. You'd be surprised how many times the doer comes back to watch the investigation.
Anyway, you're protecting the crime scene, not watching it.
Got it.
Good. The sheriff's forensic team arrived shortly after that, and Bosch ordered everyone out of the pharmacy so the photographer could go in and take a preliminary photo and video sweep of the crime scene with only the bodies in view. While waiting outside, Bosch pulled on gloves and a pair of paper booties. Once the all-clear came from the photographer, the whole team entered the Farmacia, passing through a plastic crime scene containment curtain that had been hung by the techs over the door. Gooden and Sanders separated and continued to process the bodies. Lourdes and Bosch first went behind the pharmacy counter, where Gooden and one of the crime scene techs were examining the first body. Lourdes had a notebook out and was writing down a description of what she was seeing. Bosch leaned close to his partner's ear and whispered,
"Take the time to just observe. Notes are good, but clear visuals are good to keep in your mind."
"Okay, I will."
When Bosch was a young homicide detective, he worked with a partner named Frankie Sheehan, who always kept an old milk crate in the trunk of their unmarked car. He'd carry it into every scene, find a good vantage point, and put the crate down. Then he'd sit on it and just observe the scene, studying its nuances and trying to take the measure and motive of the violence that had occurred there. Sheehan had worked the Danielle Schuyler case with Bosch, and it sat on his crate in the corner of the room where the body was left nude and viciously violated on the floor. But Sheehan was long dead now, and would not be taking the free fall that was awaiting Bosch on the case.
Chapter 4 La Farmacia Familia was a small operation that appeared to Bosch to rely mostly on the business of filling prescriptions. In the front section of the store, there were three short aisles of shelved retail items relating to home remedies and care, almost all of them in Spanish-language boxes imported from Mexico. There were no racks of greeting cards, point-of-purchase candy displays, or cold cases stocked with sodas and water. The business was nothing like the chain pharmacies scattered across the city. The entire back wall of the store was the actual pharmacy, where there was a counter that fronted the storage area of medicines and a work area for filling prescriptions. The front section of the store seemed completely untouched by the crime that had occurred there. Bosch moved down the aisle to the left,
which brought him to a half-door leading to the rear of the pharmacy counter. He saw Gooden squatting down behind the counter next to the first body, that of a man who appeared to be in his early 50s. He was lying on his back just behind the counter, his hands up and palms out by his shoulders. He was wearing a white pharmacist's jacket with a name embroidered on it.
"Harry, meet Jose," Gooden said. "At least he's Jose until we confirm it with fingerprints." Through and through, gunshot to the chest.
He formed a gun with his thumb and finger as he gave the report and pointed the barrel against his chest.
"Point blank?" Bosch asked.
"Almost," Gooden said. 6 to 12 inches. Guy probably had his hands up and they still shot him. Bosch didn't say anything. He was in observation mode. He would form his own impression about the scene and determine if the victim's hands were up or down when he was shot. He didn't need that information from Gooden. Bosch squatted and looked across the floor around the body, and bent down further to look under the counter.
"What is it?" Lourdes asked.
"No brass," Bosch said. No ejected bullet casings indicated one of two things to Bosch. Either the killer had taken the time to pick up the casings, or he had used a revolver, which did not eject bullet casings. Either way, it was notable to Bosch. Picking up critical evidence showed a cool calculation to the crime. Using a revolver could indicate the same. A weapon chosen because it would not leave critical evidence behind. He and Lourdes moved into the hallway to the left of the pharmacy counter. The 20-foot passageway led to the work and storage areas and a restroom. There was a door at the end of the hall with double locks and an exit sign as well as a peephole. It presumably led to the back alley from which deliveries would come. Just short of the door, Sanders, the second coroner's tech, was on his knees next to the other body, also a male wearing a pharmacist's coat. The body was chest down, one arm reaching out towards the door. There was a trail of blood smears on the floor leading to the body. Lourdes walked down the side edge of the hallway, careful not to step in the blood.
"And here we have Jose Jr.," Sanders said. "We have three points of impact, the back, the rectum, the head, most likely in that order."
Bosch stepped away from Lourdes and crossed over the blood smears to the other side of the hallway so he could get an unobstructed view of the body. Jose Jr. was lying with his right cheek against the floor, eyes partially open. He looked like he was in his early 20s, a meager growth of whiskers on his chin. The blood and bullet wounds told the tale. At the first sign of trouble, Jose Jr. had made a break for the rear door, running for his life down the hallway. He was knocked down with the first shot to the upper back. On the floor, he turned to look behind him, spilling his blood on the tiles. He saw the shooter coming and turned to try to crawl toward the door, his knees slipping on and smearing the blood. The shooter had come up and shot him again, this time in the rectum, then stepped up and ended it with a shot to the back of the head. Bosch had seen the rectum shot in prior cases, and it drew his attention.
"The shot at the pipe. How close?" he asked.
Sanders reached over and used one gloved hand to pull the seat of the victim's pants out taut so the bullet entry could be clearly seen. With the other hand, he pointed to where the cloth had been burned.
"You got up in there," Sanders said, "point blank."
Bosch nodded. His eyes tracked up to the wounds on the back and head. It appeared to him that the two entrance wounds he could see were neater and smaller than the one shot to Jose Sr.'s chest.
"You thinking two different weapons?" he asked.
Sanders nodded.
"If I were betting," he said.
"And no brass."
"None evident. We'll see when we roll the body, but that would be a miracle if three shells ended up underneath."
Bosch nodded in reply.
"Okay, do what you have to do," he said.
He carefully stepped back down the hallway and moved into the pharmacy's work and drug storage area. He started by looking up and immediately saw the camera mounted in the corner of the ceiling over the door. Lourdes entered the room behind him. He pointed up, and she saw the camera.
"Need the feed," he said. "Hopefully off-site or to a website."
"I can check that," she said. Bosch surveyed the room. Several of the plastic drawers where stores of pills were kept were pulled out and dropped to the floor, and loose pills were scattered across it. He knew a difficult task of inventorying what had been in the pharmacy and what had been taken lay ahead. Some of the drawers on the floor were larger than others, and he guessed that they had contained more commonly prescribed drugs. On the work table there was a computer. There were also tools for measuring out and bottling pills in plastic vials as well as a label printer.
Can you go out and talk to the photographer? He asked Lourdes. Make sure you got all of this stuff in here before we start stepping on pills and crunching them. Tell him he can start videoing the crime scene processing now, too.
On it, Lourdes said.
After Lourdes went out, Bosch moved into the hallway again. He knew they would need to collect and document every pill and piece of evidence in the place. A homicide case always moved slowly from the center out. In the old days, he would have stepped out at this point to smoke a cigarette and contemplate things. This time he went out through the plastic curtain just to think. Almost immediately, his phone vibrated in his pocket. The caller ID was blocked.
That wasn't cool, Harry, Lucia Soto said when he answered.
Sorry, we had an emergency, he said. Had to go. You could have told us. I'm not your enemy on this. I'm trying to run interference for you. Keep it below the radar. If you play this right, the blame will go on the lab or your former partner, the one who's dead. Are Kennedy and Tapscott with you right now? No, of course not. This is just you and me. Can you get me a copy of the report you turned in to Kennedy? Harry?
I thought so. Lucia, don't say you're on my side, running interference for me if you're not. You know what I mean?
I can't just share active files with... Look, I'm in the middle of things here. Give me a call back if you change your mind.
I remember there was a case that meant a lot to you once. We were partners, and I was right there for you. I guess things are different now.
That's not fair, and you know it.
And one other thing? I'd never sell out a partner. Even a dead one. He disconnected. He felt a pang of guilt. He was being heavy-handed with Soto, but felt he needed to push her toward giving him what he needed.
Since he had finished his career with the LAPD working cold cases, it had been many years since he had worked a live murder scene. With the return of crime scene instincts came the tug of old habits. He felt a deep need for a cigarette. He looked around to see if there was anyone he could borrow a smoke from, and saw Lourdes approaching from the short end of the block. She had a troubled look on her face.
What's wrong?
I came out to talk to the photographer and got signaled up to the tape. Mrs. Esquivel, the wife and mother of our victims, was stopped at the tape and she was hysterical. I put her in a car and they're taking her to the station.
Bosch nodded. Keeping her away from the crime scene was the right move.
You up for talking with her? He asked. We can't leave her over there too long.
I don't know, Lourdes said. I just ruined her life. Everything that's important to her is suddenly gone, her husband and her only child.
I know, but you have to establish rapport. You never know. This case could go on for years. She's going to need to trust the person carrying it. You've got Spanish and a lot of years ahead of you here. I don't.
Okay, I can do it.
Focus on the son, his friends, what he did when he wasn't working. Enemies, all that stuff. Find out where he lived, whether he had a girlfriend, and ask the mother if Jose Sr. was having problems with him at work. The son is going to be the key to this.
You get all of that from a shot up the ass?
Bosch nodded. I've seen it before, on a case where we talked to a profiler. It's an angry shot. It has payback written all over it.
He knew the shooters?
No doubt. Either he knew them, or they knew him. Or both. Chapter 5 Bosch didn't get to his home until after midnight. He was beat from a long day working the crime scene and coordinating the efforts of the other detectives as well as the patrol division. He had also been drawn into briefing Chief Valdez on where the investigation stood before the chief faced the cameras and reporters that had gathered on the mall. The update was concise. No suspects. No arrests. The assessment for the media was accurate, but the investigators of the Farmacia murders were not without leads. The murders and subsequent looting of the store's supplies of prescription drugs had indeed been captured on 3 cameras inside the drugstore, and the full-color videos gave insight into the cold calculation of the crime. There had been 2 gunmen wearing black ski masks and carrying revolvers. They cut down Jose Esquivel Sr. and his son with a coldness that implied planning, precision, and intention. Bosch's first thought after seeing the videos was that they were hitmen there to do a job. Stealing pills was simply a cover for the true motive for the crime. Sadly, initial viewings of the video revealed few usable identifiers of either shooter. When one of the men extended his arm to shoot Jose Sr., his sleeve pulled back to reveal white skin, but nothing else stood out. After parking in the carport, Bosch skipped the side door entrance to the house and walked out front so he could check his mailbox. He saw that the top of the box attached to the house was held open by a thick manila envelope. He pulled it out and held it under the porch light to see where it had come from. There was no return address and no postage on the envelope. Even his own address was missing. The envelope only had his name written on it. Bosch unlocked the door and carried it inside. He put the envelope in the mail he had received down on the kitchen counter while he opened the refrigerator to grab a beer. After his first draw on the amber bottle, he tore open the envelope. He slid out a 1-inch thick sheaf of documents. He recognized the top report right away. It was a copy of the initial incident report relating to Daniel Schuyler's murder in 1987. Bosch riffled through the stack of documents and quickly determined that he had a copy of the current investigative file. Lucia Soto had come through. Bosch was dead tired, but he knew that he would not be going to sleep anytime soon. He dumped the rest of the beer down the drain, then brewed a cup of coffee on the Keurig his daughter had given him for Christmas. He grabbed the stack of documents and went to work. After his daughter had left for college, the family dinners became a rare occurrence. Bosch turned the dining room of the small house into a workspace. The table became a desk wide enough to spread investigative reports across. Reports from cases he was pulling out of the jail cell at San Fernando, or that he had taken on privately. He had also installed shelving on the two walls of the alcove, and these were lined with more files and books on legal procedure and the California Penal Code, as well as stacks of CDs and a Bose player for use when his vinyl collection and phonograph didn't cover his musical needs. Bosch slotted a disc called Chemistry in the Bose and put the volume at mid-range. It was an album of duets between Houston Person on tenor sax and Ron Carter on double bass. It was part of an ongoing musical conversation, their fifth and most recent collaboration, and Bosch had the early recordings on vinyl. It was perfect for midnight work. He took his usual spot at the table with his back to the shelves and the music and started going through the cache of documents. Initially, he divided the documents along lines of old and new. Reports from the original investigation of Daniel Schuyler's murder, many of which he had written himself 30 years before, went into one pile, while the newer reports, prepared during the current reinvestigation, went into a second stack. While he clearly remembered the original investigation, he knew that many of the small details of the case had receded in his memory, and that it was prudent for him to start with the old before reviewing the new. He was first drawn to the chronological record, which was always the starting point for reviewing a case. It was essentially a case diary, a string of brief dated and timed entries describing the investigative moves made by Bosch and his partner Frankie Sheehan. Many of the entries would be expanded upon in summary reports, but the chrono was the place to start for step-by-step overview of the investigation. There was not a single computer in the robbery-homicide division in 1987. Reports were either handwritten or typed out on IBM Selectrix. Most of the time, chronos were handwritten. They were on lined paper in Section 1 of the murder book. Each investigator, including those filling in or handling ancillary case tasks, would follow their own entries in the log with their initials, even though the different handwriting styles made the identity of the author obvious in most cases. Bosch was looking at photos of the original case chrono and recognized his handwriting as well as Sheehan's. He also recognized the two different report writing styles he and Sheehan employed. Sheehan, who was the more experienced of their team, used fewer words and often wrote in incomplete sentences. Bosch was more verbose, a characteristic of his report writing that would change over time as he learned what Sheehan already knew. Less is more, meaning the less time you spent on paperwork, the more time you had to following the leads of the case. And fewer words on the page also meant fewer words for a defense attorney to twist into his own interpretation in court. Bosch had gotten his detective's badge in 1977 and spent 5 years working in various divisions and crime units before he was promoted to homicide detective and posted first at Hollywood Division, and then eventually the Elite Robbery Homicide Division, working out of Parker Center downtown. At RHD, he was paired with Sheehan, and the Schuyler case was one of the first murders they handled as lead investigators. Daniel Schuyler's story was the universal story of Los Angeles, with an added irony of origin. Raised by a single mother who worked as a motel maid in Hollywood, Florida,
She filled the holes in her life with applause that came with success in beauty pageants and on the high school stage. Armed with her beauty and fragile confidence, she crossed the 3,000 miles from Hollywood to Hollywood at age